Welcome to MicroCollege. My name's Jacob Hunt. I'm the director of Thoreau College, a microcollege located in rural southwestern Wisconsin. Right now, Thoreau College, we're accepting applications for our spring 2025 Metamorphosis Gap Semester program. In the coming months, we'll also be opening up applications for our summer field school, which is July 2025, and the fall Metamorphosis Gap Semester in the fall of 2025. Also, can check out the Driftless Folk School. We have classes happening throughout the year, and also performances and events of all kinds. Today on the podcast, I'm very excited to have a couple of guests who are joining me all the way from Barichara in Colombia in South America. This is Jacob Zeidler and Felipe Medina. Welcome, guys, for joining us today.
Thank you very
Thank you for
much.
having us.
Felipe and Jacob are two of the founders of a really interesting experiment, a new entry into the microcollege and experimental education for adults field, really setting a new landmark in South America. Suna Barichara is a living education platform created to support people to become the authors of their lives and weave futures of connection and reciprocal flourishing of life. This is what they mean by growing whole. Based in Barichara, Colombia, Suna offers an open registry and a series of learning routes that grant locals and visitors the possibility of meeting meaningfully to learn how to live better on Earth in connection. Suna is an indigenous Colombian word that means the meeting of important or sacred paths. So, thanks again for joining us. I'd like to start, as we always do here on the Micro College podcast, by asking a bit about your lives. So maybe, Felipe, could you maybe start sharing a bit about where you were when you were 18, 19, 20 years old? Where were you? Who were you with? What were the important features of that time that impacted your life?
Well, when I was 18 years old, more or less, I graduated from school. And actually, I was meant to go actually to an Ivy League school in the States. I had done the whole application, the whole thing, and I had been accepted. And yet my life, and I would say like my inner universe, was in just a very deep turmoil. So, I grew up in a war-torn country, and a lot of the reality that I lived in made no sense to me. So I went off for a gap year in a travel through South America, and I found a universe and a world of possibilities that was not exposed to me. And I found that the world was a place worth living. And I discovered a series of like sensibilities and possibilities in myself that had been concealed throughout all of my conventional education. So when I got back to Colombia and allegedly I was supposed to go to the university, I decided not to. And I decided that I wanted to, in a way, to follow the less beaten path, and just like find a new way of education for myself. So what I ended up doing was I traveled for 7 years in total. I lived some time in the Amazon. I lived some time in the States, and I think a big chunk of that process was really a process of like self-awareness and knowing myself. It seemed so evident that after all those years of schooling, I had no idea who I was. And once that became a little bit more clarified, I started feeling what were my genuine interests and passions. And then the last years of those travels, I was doing internships at really cool projects where I was like gathering the tools and the skills that I needed to pursue the work that I do today in my life. So that was my story in a glimpse.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I think there's elements of that story which I've been asking this question now for over 2 years to people and people who are starting new things, who are educators, who are thinking seriously about the world. And they're so travel at that age is often very, very important and eye-opening. And I think it does, changing of context seems to be something that does allow people to realize things like what you're saying about, not understanding yourself, not meaning in the world. So it's wonderful to hear another example of that. Thank you, Felipe. What about you, Jacob? Where were you in that period of life, and what were the what stands out as the important landmarks?
I mean, I'm originally from Germany. I've been living in Colombia for 2.5 years now, but I grew up in Germany and had the chance to go to the US when I was 15, 16 on an exchange year. And that, again, travel as a young person just completely flips your perspective, right? So by the time that I was 18, finishing my last 2 years of high school in Germany, I was planning to study computer science, go down that route, like go to the university. Do it exactly like my parents did it. My dad is an engineer and my mom's a teacher. So I always had that as the set route, just through socialization. You don't even question it. And then during my last semester in high school, I started thinking, wait, is this really what I want to do? Where do I want to go? And then, like, there was this slow unraveling of all the assumptions that I had about, okay, where do I want to go in life? What is the path that I'm supposed to be walking on? And what is the path that I actually want to be walking on? And so the first switch that I still managed to do before I went to university was instead of studying computer science to study philosophy. And then to instead of study at the best university in Germany, go and be like one of those elite people that then gets hired by Microsoft or something like that, to go and study in Malta, a small island country in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, and see what I would find there studying in English in another country. And from there on, my life became a massive adventure. I did the second year of university in Japan, traveling around. That's where I was hit by the corona pandemic in 2020. Then the last year I spent living in Slovenia while taking classes online, transferring to the University of Venice. So things went kind of haywire after that. But what really was important for me during that time was the slow unraveling of this is the path that I'm supposed to be on. But is it really the path that I want to be on? That slowly, with time and having some distance from my life in Germany, my family, I was able to give myself permission to not walk it and find what I actually want to do. And now I've been living in Colombia for 2.5 years. So.
Yeah, that permission from a family is not a given, right? It definitely is. I think both of you from different countries, different cultural backgrounds. I wonder that question, how have your families responded to your unorthodox pathways, after high school and then and the what you're doing now? Either one.
Well, I can begin. I think at first it was quite challenging for my family. I also grew up in a family that was passing through a lot of turmoil at that moment. So I think like there was really like little capacity to support me in those conversations, where I was finding the path. And I think that there was some, there was an important distance that was created that was important, that was meaningful. I remember my mother just like one day she questioned me. She said, like, it's very easy to think like you do when you're living off your parents' money, she said,
Yeah.
no? And from that day, I decided not to touch my parents' money. So, like I juggled in the streets, I played music in bars or whatever. I was like, I'm not gonna touch that money so that way I can have like freedom of thinking. And it actually became quite a challenge, later on in life to be able to receive back from my parents and like honor that legacy and so forth. Because definitely there was like a de-identification that was meaningful, that was important. With time, I've had, I guess like feedback both from my parents, like saying, after all, I think you chose the right path.
Yeah.
Simply by, having a certain capacity to be present when things go astray or when there's like serious conflicts and so forth. I think like the capacities and sort of like the foundations of life that I learned by means of not following the conventional route have been helpful in supporting my family later on. So that's a little bit of how this story played out.
Well, it's great to have that information that, yeah, wherever it comes along. What about you, Jacob? I know, I mean, the German education system is a system, right? And it is the kind of the template for a lot of education systems around the world. So to step out of that, I think is striking to me as something that takes extra courage or somehow, how were you able to think outside of the box there?
Yeah, I mean, the German education system is fantastic. Even now, they recently changed it so that any foreigner can go to Germany and study at the universities for the same price as Germans would,
Wow.
which means about 300, 400 euros per semester. Compared to US college prices, that is ridiculous. And almost all of the masters are taught in English, anyways. So it was always super easy to just keep walking that path because it is so well set in Germany, at least in my socio-demographic background, I suppose. But yeah, when I was talking about permission, it was really permission for myself. My parents were always super supportive of everything that I was doing, which made it almost a bit more difficult because I had so much freedom and anything that I wanted to do that it's this paradox of choice thing, right? You don't really know how to go about it. But it was, yeah, this like slow distancing myself and inquiry, self-inquiry as I was going through the different places that I visited, of asking myself, yeah, over years, what do I actually want to do? And then even after finishing my bachelor in philosophy, international relations and economics, I was still immediately looking, okay, what master's degree should I do? I've been not really liking university for a year, but it's the easiest path. I spent 2 weeks just looking at master's degrees until I finally able to give myself the permission to say, no, I don't want to. I don't really want to go back into the university system immediately. And then went volunteering in Spain and then to Colombia. So it's really like this inner permission that I really had to work the confidence to give myself. Yeah. Because when you choose your own path, you have to justify it to yourself. Like, why am I using my time for this? And that took me a while.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this because my eldest child, I have four kids. My eldest daughter just graduated from high school, and as of last week, she was off on a gap year in France, and she figured out her own way, a kind of an au pairing kind of job, and navigated her way. So I felt like a real sense of accomplishment as a parent in that setting, because I do think that is to go off to a foreign country and to is something that takes an extra level of organization and confidence, especially on your own. So yeah, I think the here at Thoreau College, we're blessed with many parents who are very supportive of the students who come to our programs. And I do think I also talk to students who have a harder time sometimes convincing their parents that this might be something that would be a good idea, or themselves indeed, right? As you're saying, right? It's your own acceptance and approval is important and often the biggest barrier. Yeah. Cool. Thank you for that snapshot into your lives. I think one of what I'd like to go to next is that in this process of building a micro college, a place-based micro college here, and especially in having these podcast conversations on the Micro College podcast, it is lit up on the map of the world, a whole set of fascinating, unique communities that are kindred to our community here in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And absolutely one of them, a place that I'm very much looking forward to visiting someday in the not too distant future, is Barichara, Colombia. So could you give us a picture of what Barichara is like, ecologically and culturally, and what makes it the special place that it is?
Well, I can say like Barichara is a place that is very much on the outskirts. So it's located at the cliff of what would be like, I think, a 500, 600 feet canyon.
Meter, 500, 600 meter canyon.
Yeah. And it's a place where there's no there's no main road that comes here. No, actually the paved road was built like 50 years ago, more or less. Before that, there was only like a dirt road. And because of that, another historical reasons, it's a place that has been sort of on the margins of modernized development. That and also a very particular history of colonization, where the indigenous people decided to choose death over slavery, made it a place where there's been a different storyline playing than in most places in the world. And for the last 30 or 40 years, it has become a hub of culture and creativity. It was declared a national heritage town. And it's been receiving this diaspora for some time of people that are looking for new models of development, basically. And so there's been this very rich tape cultural tapestry that's been created, both from like the native people who have found a way to be sovereign in themselves, and to have this distance from modernization, and also from this exodus of travelers who have learned to recognize the value of this place as that capacity to be sovereign, no, to have self-authorship at a collective level, no. And this is this is the setting where Tsune is created. Yeah.
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 Jacob.
To give a bit more of a picture, we're in the eastern outskirts of the Andes Mountains. So this has become a tourist hub because we are on the edge of a canyon. Actually, 20 kilometers away from us is the second longest canyon in the world after the Grand Canyon, which nobody knows about. Chicamocha Canyon, second longest canyon, absolutely massive, beautiful. Nobody really knows about it. We are on a side canyon of that, looking at these 3,400 meter high massive mountains covered in wild jungle that until a few decades ago, one of the guerrilla parties was hiding in. So they actually had to do some work to demine that. Now it's safe, I've been told, but who knows? And the ecology is dry tropical forest. So we actually do have a rainy and a dry season, which means that we have a fantastic mix of cactuses, trees that lose their leaves, birds that bring seeds over from the super rainy mountains that are basically on the other side of the mountain is the biggest river of Colombia, the Magdalena River, from which a lot of rain comes. But when it comes to these mountains, it rains down there. So there you have rainforest about 20 kilometers away from us, and we have dry tropical forests. So we have this massive mix that is super unique of seeds being interchanged between these two ecosystems, the rainforest and the dry tropical forest, which creates an incredible amount of endemic species. Right now there are a lot of projects that have been built around trying to recreate this dry tropical forest because it's one of the few ecosystems that can't regenerate by themselves. Once the forest has been lost because it is so dry. It has a lot of difficulty to reseed the plant and then tree structures. So there's a lot of work trying to harvest rainwater again, build the soils, do agroforestry as a more sustainable way than just chopping everything down and growing tobacco as was done for cash crops 50 years ago, because more and more people moved here, so they needed to make money. So it's a super fascinating, besides the indigenous perspective and history, super fascinating place ecologically. And what this has led to is, as Felipe said, this place of community where you feel like you're surrounded by people that really proactively want to create a better future together, which is so difficult to experience in pretty much any place in the world, except for these small hubs that have formed, like Viroqua or Barichara.
Yeah, I think it strikes me. So our geographical context here in Viroqua, we are in the middle of the Driftless region, which is this hill country in the middle of the Midwest. So and it has a real history of erosion, soil erosion because of the hills, and a lot of the industrial agricultural and or even the earlier the first agricultural processes happened here, had a lot of did a lot of damage to the soil, and also challenging to the massification of it, of agriculture. So a lot of the creativity and culture that we experience here are collected to the fragileness of the landscape in a way. And it strikes me that there's something similar with Barichara, like what you describe that history of slash and burn agriculture and the brittle kind of environment is something that has attracted people who are interested in regeneration and how do you work with a landscape that's been damaged. Does that sound right?
I think in general, like the appreciation of the fragility of any landscape really is a source of meaningful connection with the ecosystem, I think, no? And I think here, because as Jacob mentioned, we are in a place where there's a lot of like exchange of currents, like climatically, this is a place that has a lot of movement. So the ecosystemical response to that movement was a very sophisticated, it's a very sophisticated response, no? This hybrid form of tropical dry forest ecosystem. So I think like the fragility and the beauty come hand in hand, and this beauty inspires creativity.
So in that context, right, this unique environment and unique kind of culture that's formed there, you are building what you're describing as a living education platform, right? So that's an interesting description. So can you talk to us about, the origins of Suna and what sorts of activities are you doing? What is it like to this phase of the development of this initiative?
So Suna was created basically by connecting the different projects that already existed in the region. So, you know, it acts, it's like it's a mycelia sort of structure where basically we identified that there was this forest growing, if you will, no, this forest of human initiatives that were all aligned in along this, you know, intention of, you know, holistic growth, or, you know, buen vivir, we call it here. And we identified that creating connectivity between these different, you know, processes of growth would be something that could be beneficial both for the system in itself and from all of its individual components, no? So based on that, you know, we right now have an ecosystem that's comprised, I think, roughly about like 30 different projects, which is really amazing, you know, when you think that the town has 7,000 inhabitants in total and 2,000 inhabitants in the town, to have 30 different regenerative projects, you know, that's something really, really
Amazing.
amazing. So we've connected all of these projects, and then we offer educational routes that are tailor-made, you know, both for groups and for individuals, where they can navigate through the educational offerings that this ecosystem creates, while also stimulating the system while they do so. So it's very much based on creating synergies, you know, creating synergies between the projects and between sort of like the learners and the teachers, so as to foster basically new models of development. Like, you know, it's how can we reshape what we consider valuable, and how can we gather the capacities to really care for what's valuable in life.
It's incredible that we basically started sending out this call for, hey, we're creating this platform where you can offer volunteering opportunities and workshops and so on. And we just got one person after the other messaging us saying, yeah, I would like to be part of it. And then after actually offering the first route, it was such an incredible experience to see, on the one hand, the person that we were guiding through this experience to grow as he was feeling the sense of community, which is something that is very difficult to put on a poster. Hey, come to Barita and find out what it's like to be part of a community. Doesn't really sound very convincing. But when you're here every single time, probably this happens in Viroqua as well. Like, people that actually come to the place don't want to leave anymore. So as you go and experience these various projects, what the main structure that we have been building is usually doing some sort of work experience where you can actually use your hands and learn what it's like to not sit in front of a computer, but actually use your hands. And agroforestry projects, rainwater harvesting, those kinds of settings. And then in the afternoon, do a more personal reflection or skills-based work. So doing workshops in anything from Tai Chi and painting to, well, okay, how do I actually design an entire water rain harvesting system? And then personal mentoring sessions to either do it more on a job focused, because there are so many different projects here. Agroforestry definitely is the main one that we have been cooperating with until now, but there's projects in trauma healing. There's a community store that has been slowly building itself up through reciprocity. There's people that work in incredible amounts of different arts. So We have that as the kind of job-based mentoring, which we then started facilitating. Also, Felipe mainly started reaching out to friends that were working in the area that the participant was interested in. And then also the more personal inquiry, the inner inquiry that goes along with, I'm in a new setting. What the heck do I do now? Because when you're transplanted from, for example, the US into Colombian culture, as we talked about before, traveling like that does a lot to you because you suddenly notice all of the small habits that you have built based on your culture that suddenly don't really seem to match anymore what you're seeing around you. So, both guiding that outer process of what it feels like to work with the body, to learn actual physical skills, and then the reactions that cause it inside is what this program is really all about, the routes that we're designing.
So you talk about a registry and learning routes, right? And that's, I think, first of all, I wanted to really resonate about what you're saying about how the challenge of explaining what it's like to come into a place like Barichara or Viroqua, and with all these different initiatives, different individuals who are doing these things, and just a quality of community that you find in a place where that you have that going on. How easy it is to experience when it's there, and how hard it is to explain it to someone who hasn't. That really is, I resonate with that a lot. So I wanna do everything we can in this conversation to flesh that out, and so people who hear this can say, oh, that's what that's like. Especially at this day. So you described you've had a participant there for a year, and so that it found
2 months, 2 months, not a
6
year.
months. Oh, okay.
2 months, yeah.
Yeah. So. Highly individualized, right? That's a you are working individually with a person and with their interests and their stage of life. And is that as you look forward, I understand you're kind of discovering what's here as you go along. But is that something you're going to be do you see yourself building on, or is this or and would you like to have groups and or group kind of cohorts as well?
Yeah, well, what we're dreaming a little bit on the future and creating are a series of different offerings. On one hand, we are preparing the ground to offer more like sabbatical journeys, like people who want to be here like more on a long term, like a year kind of time framework, where we can support them in this highly personalized way, like navigating that transitioning into basically what could be a more purposeful life, regenerative scope and so forth. So we have like a line of work which are like sabbatical processes. Then we're building also like week-long learning journeys for people who are more, they're not really in this sabbatical framework, but only have a one week that they can take a year or whatever, and we want to offer like a very high quality, like inspiring experience so that can sow seeds of change. And then what we're starting to do beginning next year is offering our education programs for locals, which is really one of the foundations of SUNA. So far, in a way, the work that we've done also to receive foreign students and so forth is conceived as a reciprocity model, so that we could have funding for locals. As there's very different economical realities between global north and this tropical continent, and we're beginning to set up already this sort of like entrepreneurship program for local youth that's based on this idea of as to how can we elicit the creative possibilities in this territory for the local youth. This is what we're dreaming and thinking right now.
Yeah, so that's a fascinating question that we also talk about here. Are as you start to explore this, are there different needs or different, in addition to the economic differences, are there pedagogical curricular differences between the needs of a local audience versus an international audience?
I mean, it's a I guess it's a sort of like delicate subject, but I think like I think often both conservation and regeneration are possibilities of the privileged. Yeah, and even to frame that as an intention is a possibility of a place of privilege. That on one side, right? Because you know that right here, you know, right now here, there's a lot of challenges that relate directly to livelihood, you know, livelihood, just b basic survival. And people who are working in the land, most of the time, you know, they're dealing with livelihood. So livelihood needs to be contemplated in the design. You know, it is not philosophical, it's not education. It needs to resolve livelihood. And then the paradoxical thing is that these same people very often have a lot of concealed richness, or richness that they don't perceive as richness, no? And this can be the richness of their relationship with the land. Very often these people are land tenants. But the models with which the economy has provided you know, a way of generating value from the land are becoming obsolete, no? They have richness in terms of what the culture offers and so forth. So what we're looking to do is how can we visibilize that richness so as to share it with the people that are coming from outside, you know? And how can we also activate, you know, a flow of resources so that there could be endogenous creativity for the care of life, no? And in this sense, what we consider is that we want to create symbiosis between different parameters of richness and wealth, and be able to see the richness and wealth that exists here, and be able to see also the scarcity, and be able to see, you know, the richness and wealth that it's exists in the States, and also its scarcity, no? I think in the States, the last time I checked that stat, I think it was 40% of the people were taking antidepressants, for example. I think in Barichara, maybe 5% of the people or 2% of the people are taking antidepressants, if so. So, you know, there's like different parameters, and we want to create, you know, this union of worlds for the creation of mutual benefit.
Yeah, that's some powerful topics to contemplate there. Jacob, do you want to add something to
That was very
that?
similar to what I was going to say, so perfect. Yes.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the observations I've had about our work here and also many of these conversations I've been having is that these initiatives, micro colleges, gap year programs, these just cultural initiatives that are kind of trying to think in new ways about the intersection of education and agriculture and the arts and just higher culture in general. They are often we're locating ourselves in rural places, in places that do have some, you know, one form or another, a history of you know, colonialism or at the very least economic extraction of some form from the land. And at least here in the United States, we are experiencing this very intense polarization between the city and the country right now, the rural and the urban divide. And so to do something like we're doing in a rural place, it brings up these questions in a way. So it seems like one of the great wounds in our world is what you're also identifying, these the differences of outlook and of need and of, you know, and but also different forms of richness that are present in different locations, even within one country. So
Yeah, for sure.
yeah, so are you know, as you start to bring international people from the global north into Barichara, how do you introduce them to the culture and to the people that are there?
I think something that is I'd say like foundational to the work we're doing here at SUNA is like embracing just global interdependency, right? I think, you know, I like very much this phrase by the Dalai Lama. It's in a book called Secular Ethics, that he says that, you know, like the positive opportunity of globalization is embracing planetary empathy. So I think, you know, like this is really the outlook. Like we realize that we need to foster this planetary empathy so as to build futures where we all fit, you know. This is part of the mission of SUNA, you know. We create self-authorship to be able to build joint future, and it's futures where we all have a place. And this goes beyond the human also, you know, when we say of that, we're speaking for all species. But it, you know, this empathy feeling about really coming forth from a place of where we are more similar than we think can create an appreciation of our cultural differences from a place where they don't serve as antagonistic, but they create, you know, like the richness of complementarity, you know? And so, like, you know, from a methodological approach, all of our processes are very personalized in the sense that we meet the people where they're at, and then we connect them with the projects and the people who can better enter in conversation with their own purposes and their needs. So, you know, while of course there's a, you know, there's a immersion in a different culture, we work with what's alive in the persons, and we create like links of connection from there. So, you know, like the belonging sense gets activated quite soon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this entire experience and what Suna is offering now, one of my personal motivations was to offer something similar that I experienced when I arrived here 2.5 years ago and immediately felt incredibly welcome, always invited to all sorts of things, able to help out with any project that I wanted, and just felt very alive. Because I was surrounded by people that were proactively trying to build a better future, not just waiting that the government says, oh, yeah, okay, you know what? Now finally we're going to solve your problem because we don't have anything else to do. But to just go ahead and say, no, okay, we can't rely on all of the outside people, the forces that be, to solve these things for us. We'll just do it ourselves. And being surrounded by that environment and attitude, I think very, very quickly was internalized by me. And then I was able to more quickly go out and find my place in the community that exists here. I immediately, like, I started founding a basketball group, a meditation group, and everything, because that's the spirit that you're very quickly infected here with. And we saw the same thing with our participant in March and April, that just very, very quickly ended up at that project. And we had a pretty tight schedule. So it was impressive that even in this free time where I would have probably just stayed home and relaxed, he immediately went out and checked out that project and met people here and there and so on. So on the one hand, the Colombian culture makes it easy, but also just this place makes it incredibly easy to find excited people to start things with you, which is so, so, so unique in this world.
Yeah, that's very familiar. People coming here, it is, you can create, okay, we're gonna have open time for people to reflect, and and then they'll fill it up with interesting stuff. Yeah, so people listening to this all around the world, and they say, wow, that I want to experience that. Is there how would they take the next step in the case of Suna right now? What is on offer, and how might people follow up with that?
You want to respond to that, Jacob?
Sure. So the main offering that we have for international people right now is the more individualized learning routes that are mainly facilitated by Felipe, since I, after the process that I've gone through here, decided to actually go back into the university system and study economics in Austria. So I'm going to get a little bit closer to the kind of people that we want to bring here from the international perspective and see a bit more, well, what is the actual problem that people have there and get to know them better. But the way that we are going to offer the programs for now is, yeah, this individualized aspect of a month, 2 months, 3 months, plus the shorter experiences if you're already in Colombia and traveling through. Barichara is a wonderful place, beautiful place that has already been very established in the tourism sector. So yeah, if you want a shorter experience, you're already in Colombia and you just want to pass through, there's a 1 week guided course where we can organize work experiences for you volunteering at different projects. And depending on your budget, which is of course a question from traveler to traveler, to have mentoring sessions with project leaders, coaching sessions with Felipe, workshops in the different parts that you're interested in. On our website, we have this registry with all of the participating projects and their offerings. So you can look at it beforehand so you know what you're getting into. Sometimes, if you have very particular interests, we'll even be able to set up special things just for you. And for the longer projects, of course, we can, based on where you're at, we would design an entire experience for you or with a group that you're traveling with. And the way that you start that is by writing us and showing that you're interested. And the first step is usually just having a little call to adventure session, as we call it, to get to know each other, see what kind of possibilities are ahead of you, and figure out what kind of path we want to walk together. So that is free. You can message us at any time and we'll set up a call with you, probably with Felipe, and figure out what we want to do together, what's your budget, what you're interested in, and it'll always work out. So we'll find something for you to
Yeah, and just to be clear, this is adults of all ages. We're not just talking
Yes.
about, I think you're maybe thinking about, you used the language of sabbatical or a little bit earlier, right? And I can tell you that there is a real hunger for this as well from people, people throughout their adult lives. They contact me, so I'm very interested in what you're doing for the purpose of seeing how you do it, because it is something that we get interested in from people who are at a turning point in their lives, whether they are retiring after a long career, or they've finished university education, and they don't know what to do next, or they are at some change in their professional life, or indeed their family life as well. So I think I'm really excited to have this as something that I can start to share with people who contact me, because it is there's a real need out there. And yeah, I wonder, maybe in looking over sort of the schedules and the kind of your ideas for structuring an experience like this, there is, there's all kinds of practical stuff, and of course driven by the interests of the people and their agricultural and artistic and other, kind of community-based activities. But there is also I can see you thinking about ceremony, about the sacred, right? You use this word that is, referring to sacred paths, and I think a sabbatical, right? It comes out of the Bible. It comes out of this, the kind of rest built into the cycle of creation, right? And I wonder if you can think about that deeper level of what a person could get from spending a couple of months, let's say, doing what the sorts of things you've been describing, and how to I guess structure that with intention also.
Well, I like very much one definition of sacred that I heard from a college teacher actually at Naropa University in the States. And she said that sacred for her was a quality of relationships. And this is like, I just felt this like, yes, like there's a universe to explore in that conception. And I think definitely that is the foundation of what we offer. Like this the whole program is meant to enhance the quality of the relationships. And that in a way is created from a systemic perspective where, amongst other things, what needs to be enhanced in the first place is relationship with self and metabolism. Like this seems like something like so essential. And in modern culture, it is often very overlooked. So, how do we relate again with our metabolism as a sacred process? And when I say sacred, I don't mean it by any religious terms, but it just has this quality of integration that keeps life together. How can we embrace and, open up to the quality of integration that holds the gift of life, no? And how can we appreciate and collaborate with that relationality in a way that creates well-being, creates enjoyment, creates calm, creates pleasure, and then that gets scaffolded into our other systems of belonging, and that finally, comes up to the question as to, okay, so what is my sacred place in life? And this is a way of saying also, what is my eco niche or what is my calling? Where is the place where I have the greatest quality of relationships in relation to the system of life, no? And this question, it's almost something that is within the self, but only when the self finds a safe space where it can devote its energy to caring, then can this question have a place to sprout. And then, of course, we're deeply inspired by indigenous cultures here in Colombia. We are in a place where there's still, I think, 80 or 90 indigenous tribes, or nations left, and have been very connected to that way of seeing and perceiving. And at the same time, we consider that there is a new historical reality that is a very fertile ground for all of us to reconceive what is sacred. So there's a very, interesting, like, creative opportunity there in embracing that with new eyes as well.
Yeah. Can you, what inspiration have you taken from indigenous cultures for the structure of this program, or what is I think that there's a lot of differences between indigenous education and upbringings and formation from kind of Western models. Is that something that's been consciously built into particular aspects of what you're trying to do?
I think, I mean, on one hand, I know, for example, like a North American author, which very much like touches the point of what I've seen as, like essentially indigenous education here in Colombia. And it's, Bill Plotkin, who speaks a lot about like the mythopoetical identity, right? And this is a phrase that he coined, but it's a principle that has been there for centuries, and it's very much, the basis of indigenous education, that considers that every being that is born already has a calling of life, like it's been bestowed with an ecological mission, and then the responsibility of the community in relation to that individual is to be able to mirror back, to reflect that ecological mission, so that the person can assume it and own it in service to the community, no? So, the our focus in education in this self in this sense, and it's what we place the emphasis on self-authorship, is like first thing that you need to learn is what is this calling, what is this ecological mission within you, and how can you, embrace that from a place of belonging and a place of merit and a place of humbleness also, so that you can cultivate the skills that can allow you to employ that in the world, no? And I would say, yeah, this is like one of the main connections. And then of course the whole like pluri-species perspective, no? Like, well, we often say it's like, like nature being an intelligent system that amongst other things guarantees the, 22% of oxygen in the atmosphere, it regulates all processes in a very intelligent way. And I think it also has the possibility of helping us, of guiding us into finding our way to participate into planetary self-regulation. This is in nature's best interest, that us humans serve to nature's self-regulation is in nature's best interest, and she is a very intelligent and capable guiding force for living processes. She is the one, no? So, from this conception is like she is very often wanting to give us the answers that we're needing if we can open up a place for hearing. So a lot of the most interesting things in the program, or in the experience that we have, are things that we cannot plan out. Are the synergies that happens when the heart becomes open and it really has the courage to embrace its vital questions. And then, the butterfly that comes, or the frog, or the snake, or the tree that falls, like all these, how the system begins to respond, saying, okay, so you've got a question ready. You've got a question ready. I can help you, build that answer.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, I think the picture of the sacred as building relationship is very, very important. And I think what you're just speaking to right there also is the sensitivity to what's emerging, right? And I do think that that's one of the reasons that education in this time needs to be very small, micro college. We've got about 10 people here now, one person at a time, like that, because we are living in a time of change, rapid change, and environmental disruption and social disruption. And I think we are called to be very flexible, to be, resilience involves ability to see what's happening and in a sensitive kind of way respond to it. I think your experiences during the COVID pandemic, Jacob, are also, a lot of people had that experience, like, oh, the structures that I thought were familiar and now are totally out the window. I mean, who am I now that these structures have dropped away? And a lot of people were really challenged by that. And also a lot of opportunities were opened up for people who were able to meet it. So that's powerful. So we're coming up to the top of our hour here. And I wanted to ask, I mean, I think your project there in Barichara is one of the best examples that I've heard of something that Henri David Thoreau, our namesake, talks about, which is a vision of the village as the university, right? And he describes, he is himself a Harvard alum from back in the early days of Harvard, and he, ambiguous, a kind of a mixed relationship to Harvard, but especially with the cost of it, right? And as you mentioned, higher education is very expensive here in the United States, and so it's easy to experience it as a something that's bought and sold, right? It is something you have to budget for and pay for, and therefore you expect to get, you're a consumer of it, right? And Thoreau, even at that time was thinking about, education, really. Is it should engage the whole community and should continue through life as well. So something that we work with very actively here in a community that I think has a lot of similarities to what you're describing is what we're doing here is of course the students who come are benefiting from this. They're enriched. Their paths are helped to be discovered and cultivated. But also we are building something for the whole community that's living here. So I'm wondering if you can think about, in addition to the formal programs you might do with local youth, like what does having something like Sunnah or having an initiative like this in a small community, what does it bring to a place like Barichara?
I think how the, I guess how the idea became initially relevant for me is that, here we have a sort of conflict in relation to land tenancy, and this whole process that's been described as gentrification. And I think this is our expression of extractive economies, and it's economy that removes value from the land, no? And so, like, thinking of other possibilities, we identified how wisdom and education is a value that can be shared without it being extracted. And how really, if you think as to what grants life quality, cultural education, collective education, I would say, is the main foundation for life quality, So we can enhance life quality by offering collective education. And this will create the recognition of the intrinsic value of life and the intrinsic value of the collective life that we have. And I think when we can recognize and appreciate the value that exists within us and within our community, we become, in a way, I don't want to say protected because it's not a defense mechanism, but extractive economies cease to be relevant because intrinsic economies re result so much more enriching. So that is what we're trying to create, an intrinsic economical model based on the value of wisdom and education as it exists, as it pertains to the land.
Wow, that is fantastic, Felipe. I'm gonna have to go. I'm glad I'm recording this and other people can hear it because I'm gonna go back and write down and twist what you said. Yeah, that's powerful. And that really resonates with what I experienced as well. Thank you for that. Yeah. Well, wonderful. I think yeah, I just want to thank you so much for your time and for your work there. And we will share all of the links to Sunnah and there's some wonderful videos I should mention. This experience that people have had there already have been well documented and information about Barichara as well. So we'll share some of those links as well to the videos. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity and the honor to be here.
Thank you very much for having us. Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed talking.